It's a pyramid scheme. The people at the top, okay, there's a very small number that are
ka-chinging.
And then everyone else is scrabbling up the greasy pole trying, with the promise that, you know, if you assist enough and you do this enough, you will break in.
If you want to be the session stars, you have to sacrifice the holidays. If you've got children and you want to go and work abroad and be with a celebrity, you've got to not see your children for 2-3 weeks at a time. There's always a sacrifice.
If you want to go to some of the big manufacturers, they won't let you in the company. You can go and sit in the office. You won't be able to walk around the factory because they don't want you to see how many of your competitors they manufacture for.
Yeah. Right.
Or you have to sign an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, to even get into the factory floor.
Like Joe said, there's nothing wrong with white label. If you want to build your brand, once you've built your brand, then go into your own formulations.
100%.
Hi, welcome to the Noble Barber Podcast. I'm Anthony LeBand, and we'll be talking to various people in the industry who've made it, and their journey and how they got here. Talking honest, cutting through the crap, and making sure your story and their story is heard to help your business and hopefully mine. If you haven't already, please hit the subscribe button, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi there, welcome back. This is The Noble Barber, and I'm Anthony LeBand. I'm still here at Wolf's, and I'm here with Joe Mills and with Dan Gregory. Part one was phenomenal, I enjoyed that. I'd like us to start talking this time about, sessions, celebrities. You know, one of the other big things that gets spoken to me all the time is the guys that I want to do one £400 haircut and call it a day. You guys have cut, I won't ask you to go through your list, but, you know, you've got a great celebrity setup. You've both worked in a very high-end session. And obviously, the agency.
Yep.
And again, the amount of barbers I speak to that are like, do you think I need an agent to get into session work? So this is the kind of where I want to go. Shall we start with why session work? How session work? How did it work for you two? How did session work start for you?
Session work was accidental for me, really. I started off in the refinery in Mayfair. And the person who probably gave me my biggest break was a guy called Adrian, who used to run Shortlist magazine. He gave me my biggest break because he had me doing all the covers for Shortlist magazine. But the problem is that what people don't tell you this, it's you just get time for print. So you wouldn't get paid for it. So you'd have to take a day's holiday to go and do it. And I look back at how much free work I did is insane. Like when I think about, if I put that into a whole number of days, it's probably over couple of years free work, but it was exciting. The session side of things for me, like, I'm nowhere near Joe's level of session Stan at all, but I love that. It's just from behind the chair, being behind the chair is fun, but it is just doing your job. This is like the other element of the job. This is the creativity. This is where you're the talent as well as the talent, because if you're not there, you're like a fifth of the team. And if you're not part of that team, then the shoot doesn't come together.
Nothing works, yeah.
And it was like a big sort of, it was just a big bit of fun for me, really, to start with. And then I got a cover doing Sam Claflin's hair for Shortlist. And I gave him a shave. We were in this crazy house. It was like an abandoned house. And I had to give him a shave. And I didn't have any running water. So I had to basically improvise. So I had to get bottles of water and pour it into like little cups and shave him. And I styled his hair a bit differently. And this is just before he became massive. It was like just before the Hunger Games came out. And he in the actual article, he mentioned me and how amazing the haircut was and the shave that I did him. And that just sent it then, really. Mm. And I used to just work with Adrian all the time. Any shoot that we ever did for Shortlist magazine, he'd always get me involved. And then when I started doing Daniel Radcliffe's hair, that was through his dad. So I started cutting his dad's hair. I didn't know his dad was Dan's dad. And that's confusing. But I just didn't know who this guy was because I never knew his surname. I just knew him by his first name. And he said, my son needs a barber. And when he's in London, would you mind doing his hair? I said, yeah, of course, yeah. Just get him booked in. He said, his publicist will message you. I was like, publicist? Okay. And then it turned out to be Daniel. And just through Dan, that's how I end up getting on loads of other stuff because I work with the publicists and we get on really well. And they knew they never used to ask me to, like, don't tweet where you are. Don't post a selfie. I can't remember who it was said to me. Someone said to me once, if you took a selfie with every one of the clients you've done, you would be way more big. You'd be bigger on social media than you are. So, I never do because no, I'm not there for that. I'm part of the team that we're sitting down having breakfast. We're not there to take photos with each other. And occasionally I'll take a picture of the hair because I'm proud of it. And then when the publication comes out, then I'll post it. But I never do the selfies with the client, with the celebrities. And that's not, I'm not saying you shouldn't, but I just feel uncomfortable doing that. Because I'm not the fan. I'm part of the team doing the work. And I found that I think I probably grew closer to these clients because of that. And I got more work out of them because of that. And I got more work from that one person. Them publicists knew that they could recommend me to every single person who needed a groomer. And then I'd end up doing all the work. I'd do loads of different press junkets, loads of different premieres. Yeah. I'd very rarely post about them because I didn't want to look as though I was like fanboying, if you get what I mean. I felt like it was a working relationship, and that's what I look at it as. It's a working relationship. Yeah. And I'd say my session's probably not like what some of the people you see were doing, like the cover of Vogue and cover all that, but mine was just so much fun. Like I felt it was just another part of the job that I did. And it was, you wouldn't actually cut hair. That's the thing that people don't know about session work. Most session stylists I know haven't cut hair in years. Mm. They just style it.
Yeah.
And these are the things that it's coming into the men's hair now, is when I'm getting a photograph of someone going, I want to look like Timothy Chalamet. Well, I'm like, there's a girl called Jamie who does his hair. And I'm pretty sure she has a 45-minute window like I do just to style his hair, not to even cut it. And I've got an hour to cut and style your hair. And then you've got to do that every single day. And it sounds like I'm always being like, sort of like, again, being like the downer in the client-barber relationship. But I'm not, I'm just being realistic. Yeah. That doesn't work like that. You cannot recreate that look that he has every single day. And if you do, you've got to have a 20-minute window to do it. So my session is probably more like I've just created loads of friends and they just happen to be famous,
right?
Which is fun. Yeah, which is the fun side of it. But I think with like the agency side of things, I've never joined an agency. I've never even been approached by an agency, to be honest, probably because I don't talk about myself that much, I guess, if I don't post about myself, about the work that I do. But the value of an agency, I definitely see, would, like, if anyone's out there looking to get into session work, the value of an agency would, I think it depends on what direction you want your career to go in. Because I feel like if you're going to be a session stylist, you have to either be a session stylist or you have to work behind the chair. I couldn't juggle both nowadays, I don't think. And my session work is definitely slowed down since COVID. I used to travel around the world, you know.
To weigh in still? Do you think the market's changed more? I mean, much more of your career has been session.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I think there's, you know, I've talked quite a lot about session work over the last couple of years. I think session work is like saying I cut hair. There are so many different elements within session work. Mm-hmm. So you could be working only in TV and film, okay, and you're doing hair on TV and film. You could be doing, you know, commercials. You could be doing editorial, which is, you know, the fashion magazines. And I'm talking, you know, all hair, not just specifically men-based. You know, or you could be doing more celebrity-based, that's where I'm definitely within that category. I still do editorial for magazines, but I do a lot of press tours, a lot of junkets, same as Dan, and red carpet. And then my clients then have commercial obligations. I do that. It's understanding within the umbrella that is session hairdressing what interests you the most. If you think you're going to be, you know, at your most creative, pushing boundaries, then, you know, then you need to be leaning more into editorial and the show work, the fashion show work. The problem, I think, within session styling and being that kind of in that kind of world, is understanding the process of getting into it, what the requirements now are. Now, I don't know about you, Dan, but from my perspective, when I first got into it, I was asked by makeup artists to come and do haircuts on guys because they couldn't do them.
Yeah, it's a shame.
So there's a lot around beards and fading. And I'm, you know, and even before that, I was doing a lot of editorial back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And I used it as a platform for my business. So when I had the lounge, I used it because of the credits. It was Joe Mills at the lounge. You know, it was a great way to go, look at the work we do. But moving on from that, now anyone that wants to really break into the men's grooming industry, you need to have an understanding of skin and skincare. You know, there isn't the budgets in the same way for someone like me and a makeup artist. Mm-hmm. They expect someone like me to be able to do men's skin. And when I talk about men's skin, I mean to basically do basic makeup. And you have to, that is almost either you're going to split your fee if you're going to get paid, you're going to split your fee with a makeup artist, or you're going to have to do it yourself. So that's definitely a skill set that I think is needed. Whether you use it every single time, argumentative, but it's definitely needed.
Yeah.
Do you need an agent? No, you don't. You know, I've until I set my own agency up 18 months ago, I never had an agent. I've been to plenty of go-sees, which is, you know, sit down with an agency and talk to them about what they can offer me. Most of them want to know what I'm already turning over and what percentage of that they can take to represent you. Really, if I was starting out in the industry and wanted to get into session work, I would make sure I've got all the tools in my toolbox. You need to know how to style hair immaculately. Yeah. You need to know how to use product, what product to use. Can I wet that product down and restyle it completely different in 10 minutes?
Yeah.
If you can't do all of that, that's what you need. It's not about how great your skin fades are in the shop under a ring light. It's got nothing to do with that, unfortunately. Or fortunately, depending on where you look at it.
How would you start now? Sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I mean... Like you said about the makeup artist, that was one of the things that I used to get asked a lot, was to go and do, like, you know, if they were doing a TV show and it was period, or it was something like, you know, like Boardwalk Empire and stuff like that. I didn't do the hair for that, but a lot of people would ask me to go on and just do the haircut, show them how to do it, and then they'd copy it.
Correct.
Yeah. So I used to do that. I'd go down for a day, do a demonstration on this haircut, see the mood board of the person's outfit and what the haircut, what they want the haircut to look like. Then I'd give my say, and then we'd show the makeup artist how to copy it. I think getting into session work nowadays, I think if you're working just doing men's hair behind the chair all day, I think it would be very hard to get into session work, because I feel like you need to have that element of blow drying.
Mm.
And men don't really, or barbers don't get taught blow drying, really. If you look at some of the work that you're seeing on the guys now, like if you look at Austin Butler's hair, that is mainly, that's Elvis's haircut,
and,
right?
And
that's all it is, it's Elvis's haircut.
Like you mentioned Timothy's styled earlier, same thing. Like, I know Jamie really well.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of I share a lot of clients with a lot of the American groomers. All of it requires a great deal of skill to be able to make someone look like they haven't had their hair styled.
Yeah, that's the thing I found really hard, because like with Dan, he doesn't want to look like I've even touched his hair.
Yeah.
But his knowledge of styling compared to my knowledge of styling, like, he just wants to do this and he's done. But I'm like, well, I can't do that. Because I need it to look this way and that way and this way and that way. So you've got to almost make it look effortless with loads of effort gone in, which is a really hard thing to do. And if you're doing the same cuts a lot of the time, but you're really creative and you want to push boundaries, you probably have to take a good bit of time out of your day or out of your shop to get mannequins and get models and just practice and practice and practice on just being creative to start with. But a lot of it isn't necessarily cutting creative or creative cutting. A lot of it is creative styling. And like the makeup, like Joe said, I was almost going to learn to do makeup because my fee was split. A lot of the people I work with was split.
Yeah. Now, I must admit,
we'll do a session. I'll teach you.
Yeah, definitely.
I'll do one this morning.
Do you think he should have had he would have done better with an agent?
No. I was talking about doing a session teaching him to do skin. No, I don't think you do better with having an agent. I think what an agent offers you is a different platform. So it offers you an option to be exposed to different natures of the beast.
Mm.
You know, you could find that Dan touched earlier about, you know, choosing to be a session stylist or in the salon. What's interesting is that pretty much every session stylist I know in the UK at some point still does a bit of salon work,
mm-hmm.
because the problem is most of the time you're on a 60 to 120 day payment cycle with the client. The work comes in peaks and troughs. You could be flat out for 3 months, do nothing for 2 months.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of session stylists, you know, still work in salons or work at home or studios or whatever. I think there is a space for both of those. The problem is if you're a session stylist, you can get a job tomorrow. And if you've got a full day's client, you've got to cancel them all, move them. And you've got to have either a clientele that's prepared to accept that because they like the kudos because you're off doing a shoot or whatever. But you have to have that as an understanding. Going back to an agent, can an agent deliver you work? Well, an agent can definitely expose you to work, but you do need to have a portfolio. Mm. It's no good someone coming to you going, I want to be a session stylist. And you go, okay, what work have you done?
Yeah.
And you've never been on set.
Yeah.
You need to assist. So going back to how to get into it. If I was new, getting into the industry, first off, I would find work of people who I really rated. So if someone looks at my Instagram page and went, wow, I want to work with Joe and do, you know, and assist him, then you have to reach out to that person, offer to assist. Chances are, if you know, there's this whole discussion about should you be paid or not. If you are observing, so you're coming on set, you're standing, you're watching, and you're just taking it all in and understanding how the whole process works, mm-hmm. then you're observing. Chances are you won't get paid for that.
Yeah.
A lot of assistants don't get paid. We try to pay everybody where we can with assisting, but often I'll shoot for nothing, but that's my choice. Mm. You know, editorials, predominantly you just get a credit. There's no payments involved. If you want to get involved in the shows, whether it's in Paris, Milan or London, find the lead hairdresser, mm-hmm. ask how to get on their team. Okay. And then it's a case of building a portfolio. Once you have a portfolio, you can then decide, do I need to have representation? What will representation bring me? Will it open that many extra doors for me, or can I hustle it on my own? Because
yeah.
a lot of it is the hustle. It's exactly what Dan was saying. You know, you meet a publicist, you get on with that publicist, and or you meet the girls at Sony that you get on really well with, and they go, actually, do you want to do this next job for me? Or you hustle at the magazines.
Yeah.
Magazines aren't the same way as it is. They're all syndicated now. It's not the same as it used to be back in the day, GQ and shortlist and stuff like that, where you got to know people and, you know, they would start booking you. Mm. The world, in honesty, is a bit of a pyramid scheme. Mm-hmm. And I'll probably get attacked for saying this. It's a pyramid scheme. The people at the top, okay, there's a very small number that are...
ka-chinging.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. And then everyone else is scrabbling up the greasy pole joint with the promise that, you know, if you assist enough and you do this enough, you will break in.
Yeah.
But there's a huge amount of people right at the very bottom desperately trying to get in.
The problem is some of those people are enormously talented and they get disillusioned and they leave. And I think that what, as a session stylist, you know, you have to be honest that you have to say, you know, you can hustle for 5 years and just about break into it. You could be really lucky and get a really good client, yeah, you know, so. Same as, and you could break in a year, 2 years.
Yeah.
And before you know it, you've got a fairly good roster. You could assist on loads of shows in Paris and Milan and still never headline a show.
Mm.
You know, there's a handful
of
those people.
And there is a lot of, and you will do quite a lot for free. You think
100%,
and that's the earner isn't quite as
listen. Anyone could sit there and go, you know, you could say to any young guy growing up, what do you want to do? I want to play for England.
Mm.
Well, guess what? There's only 11 people on that pitch.
Yeah, that's it.
There may be another 11 people sitting on the bench. There's only 22 people.
Mm.
You're gonna have to really slog it out.
It is always the same. If you look at all the work on, if you look on Instagram. And you type in, or a magazine comes up, and you look at the credits. They're usually the same names on the credits.
Yeah, it's 10 people. It's like,
yeah, because they're doing absolutely everything. Yeah. I remember I used to do Kim Jones's hair, right? And when he done his first Dior show, Kim asked me to go over and do his hair for it, right? I remember walking in, doing his hair, and then that was done. And I walked around and watched the whole show. All the hair being done, the backstage stuff being done, right? And I was blown away. And I saw Guido.
Yeah.
He walked past me. He's
phenomenal.
Eating a sandwich. And he walked past me. And I waited about 3 hours just to ask him a question. And I remember, even though I knew Kim, and you'd think that'd be my way in, it wasn't, right? And I saw Guido walk past, and I went, excuse me, Guido. I said, sorry, my name's Dan. I've just been doing Kim's hair. And I thought, I'll just give him a little bit of it. I'm not just some weird guy turning up and saying hello to you. I do know Kim, right? So I name drop Kim a little bit. I said, how do I get to your level doing this? And he went, work hard. And then he walked off. And I was like, how do I work hard though? Like, how much harder can I work?
Yeah.
But what I took away from that, because I was talking to people about that, I said, wonder what that means. It was a bit cryptic, but he was busy. So he probably just thought, you know. And I said, work hard. And I spoke to loads of different people about that. What do you mean? It doesn't mean work harder than you're doing, or work, keep doing what you're doing. It just means just keep that work ethic. Keep grinding. It doesn't matter what you're doing. How many free things you do, just keep working.
The other option you've got now, which is completely unique to this current world we live in, is you have access through Instagram, TikTok, whatever, to everybody.
Yeah.
Okay, there's nobody out there that is a really great photographer, really great fashion stylist, a really great hairdresser, groomer, barber, whatever. Anybody you want to reach out to, you can reach out to them. Mm. Whether they respond to you is different.
Yeah.
But when I was started out in the industry, you used to have to do go sees where you would take your book, sit down with a fashion editor in a magazine, and flick through and go, yeah, right, I'll be in touch. Mm. But now, like, I get people messaging me all the time, can I assist you? Can I, you know, if people want access to you, they can do it.
Yeah.
But equally, every single person in the world has got a half decent picture, a camera on their phone.
Yeah.
If you want to really kind of experiment on what you're doing, set a camera up on a tripod, get a client in, cut their hair, make, you know, even if you shoot it in black and white, so you don't have to worry about their skin, play around with lighting. You can shoot.
Yeah.
You can create your own portfolio.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be doing superstar celebrities, but you know, the opportunity for you that if you want to do it just to be creative, you know, you can do. You can be creative in your own environment. You don't have to be necessarily a session stylist.
Mm.
You know, is, you know, and you know what? I'm really, really fortunate. Over the years, I've traveled all around the world, worked with some amazing people, and had an amazing team around me, and worked with an amazing team of photographers and publicists and talent as well. But it's still a hustle. I still, you know, January's kicked off. I've got Paris coming up and Milan coming up. I'm still hustling. I'm still chasing people going, what am I needed for? When do you need me? When, you know, how much, you know, making sure everything's there. You know, it's not, you don't just sit back and go, yeah.
Yes.
No. You know, that's, and I think that's what Guido meant.
Yeah.
It's a hustle.
Yeah, it's hustle, yeah. It is, yeah. It's very insecure job, isn't it, in a way? You don't know when you're going to be needed, like you said.
Yep.
And what when you, you're saying, like, you know, you could work for like 3 months or never work again. I found that used to happen to me. When I'm working, because Dan's probably like my...
He's in filming cycles.
Filming cycles?
Correct.
They film and then they have the press tour and you don't have them for a year and then you catch up from where you left off.
Yeah.
I think as well, I think another thing to really think about as well, if you are going into that route, if you want to work with celebrities, because what you asked at the very start was, I want to do a £400 haircut for a
football.
Yeah,
no, I think that celebrity factor,
I think
that
celebrity element is that I feel like you can't be too opinionated on their hair as well. Now, what I mean by that is, I'll see loads of, like, you know, like these videos on Instagram where they do reaction videos, right? And some of them are hilarious. There's a video of Jake Gyllenhaal's new buzz cut.
Yeah.
Launched today from the Golden Globes. I saw a reaction video saying, I'd have put a taper here, I'd have done this, I'd have done that. What you've got to think about, that Jake Gyllenhaal's done that for a film. He hasn't just buzzed it off.
No.
Yeah.
He hasn't just gone down the barbers and said, can I have an 8 all over? That's done for a
there's
film.
There's been a couple of dozen conversations leading up to it.
Yeah, of course.
And an agreement in contract of what it's going
to
look like.
Yeah, everything. And you can't go, what you do better to the haircut. It's about, you've got to remember, you've got to put yourself in that frame of mind of going, he's got 3 films coming up soon. His first film, he might be doing like Jarhead again. He might be doing Jarhead 2. He might have a skin fade or something, right? It's about not saying what you do better to that haircut. It's about just accepting what needs to be done.
Yeah, and often, you know, they don't have a say.
No?
No.
That's often it, they don't.
They're having to grow their hair for a part. A manager's told them this. Even doing shoots, even doing editorial shoots with models. Okay, so these are guys that have been cast that are models. You know, you will sit there and you and the fashion stylist and the photographer will go, yeah, he looks sick with a buzz cut.
Mm.
You'd be on the phone to the agency.
Yeah.
And the agent would be like, no, he's doing Paris next week. He's got long hair.
Or you want to do a photo shoot and you go, oh, great. Got this guy here. His hair's amazing. What I'd do to that is I'd do this, isn't it?
He turns up.
Oh, it's £1,500 extra if you want to cut his hair.
Yeah.
And you're like,
or they turn up and they've had the haircut.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it is like, it's just, I think with a lot of the sessions of that I remember, what I loved doing was I loved not necessarily going in and cutting the hair. I loved going in and seeing what I could make of what I had. And I used to love that, because there'd be times where, like, I remember this one actor, in all honesty, it wasn't a very good haircut, right? And I remember looking at it going, I don't know where the hell I'm going to put this big long bit down somewhere and mold that round. And I remember he just had loads of chunks flying around, right, on the top of his hair. And I couldn't say to him, what the hell's happened to your hair there? I was like, I couldn't have an opinion. I'm there, I'm paid to do his hair. I don't have time to work out what's going on. I have to figure out how to make this haircut look decent. And it wasn't a decent haircut. And I remember having to fold hair over my finger and hairspray it and tuck it under the back bit to make it not stick out. And I found that really, it was horrible at the time. But looking back, it was one of the most favourite shoots that I ever did. Because if only people knew the level of in my way, in my head, artistic work that went into making the haircut look like that. You'd be surprised. It doesn't look like it, but it did. It took a lot of my understanding of how to move hair around and manipulate hair and blow dry hair into certain places. And I love that element of it, not actually cutting. Doing what I can with someone else's haircut. I just love doing that.
But that's part of what I was saying earlier about the toolbox. Yeah, it's about making sure that you can... You can if you need to. Yeah, you were walking into an environment and you... And I was talking to someone earlier who's a very well-known barber in the industry. And we had a chat today about, you know, getting into session work and stuff like that. And he'd been on a shoot recently and he couldn't get his head around how... He wasn't as important as he thought he was in that environment. Mm. And I'm like, you become a cog in a bigger machine.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter who you think you are. Oh, yeah. You know, yes, you might have a really good relationship with the talent and people may look to you because of that relationship. But fundamentally, you are part of something that to come up with the finished result.
Yeah.
And that, and also as well, there was a lot of hanging around. There was a lot of downtime. You might have like in an 8-10 hour day, you might work for 2 hours flat out, but you are literally sitting around in a corridor of a hotel or been, you know, your client's having to sleep for 4 hours. So you've got to go and find somewhere to go and sit and have a coffee. True. And you have to adapt to that. You know, you might, you know, you're on a 6:30 train to Paris. You're in Paris for 2 hours and you get in the train back. You've got another job in London. Mm. Sounds amazing.
It sounds glamorous, doesn't it? Yeah.
Or you're living out of a hotel for 2 weeks because you're on tour with someone and guess what? It's not all it's cracked up to be. No. So it's if I wanted to get into the industry, talk to as many people that do what I want to do.
Yeah.
Same as like, you know, when you first started out barbering and you thought, you know, I'd love to go and cut hair with whoever. Yeah. Reach out to them.
Oh, no, that's it. I mean, I made my list of who I wanted to work for and that was that. I think I kind of like that it's that part of it's still the same, but, you know, you don't have to get the yellow pages and walk door to door now.
No.
It's there and
it's
easy.
It's not money, though, is it? It's not. It shouldn't be about the money.
It isn't about the money. It can't be about the money.
It can't be about money. For me, personally, the equal value of success is money. You don't make money and not be successful.
Mm.
Unless you do crypto, but that's the only real thing, isn't it? Money comes with success. So when you want to do the £400 haircut, build the relationship first.
Mm.
Build up that relationship.
But
with
the
that
chances of like, you know, I work with some really really great people, and 9 times out of 10, I cut their hair for nothing.
Mm.
I'm not billing them £400 for a haircut.
No.
The reason I don't bill them £400 for a haircut, or I don't charge them for a haircut, is that's part of my relationship with them, and I'll get it on the back end.
Yeah,
I'll get it because I'm, you know, working with them on a shoot or something like that. I'll get paid then.
Yeah.
And that relationship of, you know, of thinking, you know, it means that I'll be able to charge, you know, X amount for a haircut. You know, I used to cut a guy's hair many years ago. He's very well known. And he would book me for a haircut at a specific time. So it might be in a London hotel, or it might be, he was a sports person, so it might be where he did his sport. And I would turn up and I would wait 2, 3, 4 hours sometimes, get to cut his hair, leave and get back home. And when I look at, you know, how much the haircut cost versus how much time I put in or how much travel I had to do, you know, was it really worth it? £300 for a haircut or £200, whatever the price was at the time, I can't think. Mm. But probably not. It wasn't about the money.
No.
It's about, you know, if you think about what I do, you know, with the agency, you know, with working at Wolf and all that kind of stuff, everything I do feeds into the product range, into, you know, it's a bigger picture stuff.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, I don't think that having the one revenue stream works. I think you have to diversify a little bit. I think having session work, cutting hair, if you want to do education. If you wanted to create content, create content. It's all about... Going back to what I said in part one, understanding what you are as a brand, and which I'll probably get slaughtered for, but understanding what you're trying to do, what's the message you want to put out there, then what can I do that supports that? So if you're going to try and do session work and break into session work, you know, and if you want to be the next Guido, great, you know, but it's a hustle. Yeah. If you want to do something so you can elevate your barber shop, so you want to do, you know, whether it's a shoot for, you know, Modern Barber, or whether it's you want to be on stage at Salon, or you want to be, you know, on a cover of GQ, work out what it is you want to do. What is it, where does it benefit? And it doesn't have to be pounds and pence at that point.
Yeah.
It's, can it lead me in down a different path? And one of the biggest lessons I learned is, don't turn down any opportunity. Yeah. And it doesn't mean you have to take the opportunity, but listen to what the opportunity is, explore it to its limit, and then decide whether or not it's right for you. Because often things have come my way and I've been a bit like, yeah, I'm not sure I want to do that. And actually I've then explored it and they've led me to other things. Yeah. So being a session stylist or being an educator or being however you see yourself in the industry, all of them feed into each other.
There needs to be a purpose for it, though.
Yeah, but work out what that purpose is.
But also, don't forget, there's always sacrifice. There's always a sacrifice with anything.
Yeah.
If you want to be the session stylist, you're going to have to sacrifice the holidays. If you've got children and you want to go and work abroad and be with a celebrity, you've got to not see your children for 2-3 weeks at a time.
Correct.
There's always a sacrifice. Yeah. And I feel like you've got to be prepared for that sacrifice. If you're not, then...
Yeah.
Really think about whether that's...
Yeah, go into it with your eyes open.
Well, yeah, exactly, yeah.
I think it's only fair, while I've got a pair of you here, is we talk about product, which I've got to be honest with you...
Such a dirty word.
Well, I mean, you're talking sacrifice. That's got to be... I mean, that to me is the... And everyone I've spoken to is this huge headache, this huge business.
Yeah.
But you guys last 2 year journey? Is 2 years too short, or is
less
that about
than that? Well, we launched in June, but we'd been... working in the background for much longer than that. Yeah. Probably since lockdown, we've been kind of figuring out what we want to do and where we want to go. Lockdown and the later stage of 2021, 2022 was really where we saw that kind of like the gap of where men were growing the hair.
Mm.
And it was like, where do we go with a range of products? Because I say this to all of my clients who've got long hair. You've got long hair with short-term mentality. You still think a clay is going to do your long hair. Yeah. You still think you can wash it every day. You still think you don't have to use conditioner. And my whole thing was, with a product range, I wanted to have something that it can be genderless. You know, it can be completely gender neutral. And that the smell has to be gender neutral. The feel of the product, the look of the product, it has to be gender neutral. And that was the starting point. And then we just found a manufacturer who could do that for us. And it was quite simple in the end, to be fair. But it just, it's a lot of time.
I love the way you're using the word just all the way through that. What about yourself?
been playing around with product ranges off and on for 10, 12 years. Yeah. So we started back in when we had Joe & Co, found a really good chemist, did some formulations, found a really good smaller batch manufacturer, played around with different things. You know, it was quite a big investment looking back at the time. But to make it work, you know, spent a lot of time talking to the high street, you know, talking to people pre-Space NK, but those kind of world about what was needed for us to really have a product range that you know, other than selling it to professionals, you know, it wasn't viable at the time. It wasn't something we could deal with. And then, you know, post-COVID, just before COVID, I was working alongside Primark, and I did a product range with Primark, which was more of a licensing deal, but I was very across all the development of it all. And it kind of made me realise that, you know, the disparity between a £20 product and a £3 product isn't that massive, really. Sometimes it's down to key ingredients. Sometimes it's down to the tooling and the packaging. It's the little things. Mm. So then now at Wolf, we have two different manufacturers, one in Australia and one in UK, that manufacture our ranges. We've got a slight diffusion range and a more premium range. It was pretty straightforward, in honesty.
Oh, it's lovely hearing just. I mean, other conversation I've had.
No,
it is nowadays, because back in the day, it was a lot harder.
You can go down multiple routes. You can white label, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
You can go to a white label manufacturer and ask them to tweak their formula, and you've now got a standalone product.
Yeah,
or you can go to a standalone chemist and say, I like this. rip it off and they'll move the product. As long
you
as
you can't
the,
trademark ingredient list, can you, or something?
No, you can't. If you could tweak anything, 8%.
That's it, 8%. That's
8% is the limit. You tweak it 8% out of a, and that could be a fragrance. You could change a fragrance in a product and it's a bespoke product.
Yeah.
So you can go, you know, and if you wanted standalone formulas and with the toing and froing, anything between 600 and 1800 quid per product per range, the issue gets to manufacture. So a lot of the big guys like the Hercos of the world won't make, so the I'll use a word called skew. And the idea is, so if you've got six products, six different waxes or six different pomades and pastes and stuff, that's six skews. Mm. So each product is a skew. If you went to someone like Herco and said, I've got six products, what's your minimum order? 10,000 a unit. Yeah, so you're looking at 60,000. So you're looking at 60,000 units that have got to be stored.
Yeah.
Okay. If you go to a manufacturer from scratch, by the time you go through all the different testing and stability testing, make sure the product doesn't go off on the shelf, all of that kind of stuff, 3 to 6 months till you get the certificates. Yeah, you know this. And then if you can find someone who do you 1,000 of each, you've still got to store 1,000 products. Yeah. So you either hope they'll drop ship and they'll store it for you and ship you what you need.
Yeah.
You know, it gets
very hard to hope just.
Yeah. There's a cost. Then you look at white labels and you go, well, actually that's not that unattractive.
Mm. Was that a passion project? Was that something that you really felt it just wasn't anything out there? That was something that was a mission for both of you?
It was, for me personally, I'd white labeled before.
Right.
When we had the shop in Marylebone, it was a very it wasn't as well known as it is now. Right. This particular manufacturer, and the reason I did that was because I wanted my brand to stand out on the street I was on. So it wasn't necessarily for a product range. It wasn't to have a product range.
It elevated my brand
because I was like, oh my God, that shop's brand new, but they've also got a product range with their logo on. Oh my God. And it was only that. It was only about, we had like five products and it was only just styling products to start with. And then.
But you saw the power of it.
Yeah. And I saw the power of branding. Mm. And I think if anybody wants to go down a product route, like Joe said, there's nothing wrong with white label. If you want to build your brand, once you've built your brand, then go into your own formulations.
100%. I totally agree with Dan.
Do you do a lot of the learning if you're doing white label? Are you learning? Is it a completely different world?
If you put into any search engine white label hair products, there will be literally, there's probably 50 companies. There's a half a dozen in the States, half a dozen in Australia that are really outstanding. There's a handful in the UK that are really, really good. You can turn around some and go, I need this, and this, and they'll send you everything. Now, you may not be able to find everything you want within what they've got, but what you'll be able to do is create a really good capsule range that you can then see what works for your business. So you've got to look at it like this, right? So, you know, we also stock other people's products, other companies as well as our own, because although ours is a big range, it's over 30 products, 36 products, I think, in the full range, you know, alongside that, there's always bits and pieces that I don't have.
Mm-hmm.
My manufacturers can't do aerosols.
Yeah.
Not in the quantities I want. So I have to use another supplier that can do me hairsprays, mousses, drying shampoos. Now, if you think about, like, all of our services are shampooed. So we shampoo and condition every single client. Okay. Every single client has some sort of styling product in their hair, whether it's, you know, across a vast range. I'm buying that product in if I'm buying someone else's, and that's a direct cost to me.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I could go to a white label company and buy all of that product and buy it in liters, and it costs me a fifth at worst, probably an eighth.
Yeah.
So my cost as a business decreases enormously. My margin on a white label product with my branding on it sold is vastly outstrips what I can get from L'Oreal, Weller, Schwarzkopf, Kevin Murphy, whoever. Yeah. I make more money. And also it's got my name on it.
Mm.
So if you think about it as a brand, if you think about it as a branding exercise, having your name all over a load of products, whether it's white label or not, who really cares? Because if I'm stocking L'Oreal, I'm white labeling L'Oreal's products.
Yeah.
I'm selling their brand for them.
Yeah.
What do I get for that?
But a lot of products are made by the same people.
They're all made by the same people.
So technically, every product pretty much is white label, into an extent.
If you want to go to some of the big manufacturers, they won't let you in the company. You can go and sit in the office. You won't be able to walk around the factory because they don't want you to see how many of your competitors they manufacture for. Yeah.
Right.
Or you have to sign an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, to even get into the factory floor.
Yeah.
They don't want you knowing that they manufacture for Jimmy Bloggs and this person and that person.
Yeah, yeah. But it's an interesting one because product is something that is, I don't really know what it's like in sort of today's barbering world of retail. When I started off, retail was quite big. I started off in a shop that was pushing American Crew a lot. And retail was big. And then I went to the refinery, especially the refinery, and that became a retail store based on their Harrods shop.
Yep.
And that was, they wanted to basically be like barbering and beauty as a side thing, even though it was what started it off. And retail became massive. And I remember the reason I was a good retailer is because I recommended and never sold. I only made 12% on a product sale. It was pointless, right? But I'd recommend it. So I always remember this one time. They always say eye level, buy level. That was the old saying thing. Yep. Eye level is buy level, right? So I remember there's one day when we had the retail front of the refinery had shampoo and conditioners over here, styling products here, shaving products over here, and whatever. And I said, why don't we put some together? Because we're never selling that conditioner. That conditioner sat there for months, if not years. Nobody's buying that. Let's put it next to the most popular product. So what I'd do is I'd put it next to, it was Knight Rider by Kevin Murphy. That was the most popular product. And I put a shampoo and a conditioner right next to it, right? And as we walked out, they were like, oh, what was that used in my hair? I said, it was Knight Rider by Kevin Murphy. Would you like to top up on your product? But yeah, do you know what? I'm going to try that. And I'll go, okay, do you need any shampoo and conditioner while you're here? And they'll look right next to it and see shampoo and conditioner. They go, oh, go on, throw them in as well. Yep. It went from a £20 product to a £60 retail product.
Right.
It sale for me, right? And the thing is with retail is that the downside to retail nowadays is that it goes a bit back to, it almost filters into pricing.
Is
that retail is almost more expensive than the haircut. It never used to be like that. American Crew started up at £9.50 and my haircut was 12 quid. Yep. Then American Crew was £16.95, my haircut was 15. Yep. And a lot of guys are like, why would I pay
this is
for
the problem.
That?
This is the problem with barbering. And I spent a lot of time talking to some big manufacturers. I mean, like the big brands, like L'Oreal's of the world and all of that, guys. The problem you've got is, it's a completely unexplored area. So if you go back to the conversation we had about pricing, which I don't want to go down that rabbit hole again, but if you're talking about your haircuts averaging between 20 and say £50, let's be really broad here, right? And you've got somebody comes in and your Kevin Murphy puck is now £24.
Mm. So it's an American Crew over the 20 quid mark
right
now, isn't it?
Now, I don't understand why L'Oreal, for example, that have got the tooling, got the formulations, got the ability to literally go, we're going to do a barbershop range and we're going to price it at 8 to 12 quid.
Yeah.
Because they would completely dominate the high street.
Yeah.
I mean, they would clean up. I had a conversation with someone recently who's from a rival to L'Oreal, and said it to him, and he's in charge of their area sales for the UK. And he looked at me like I was talking a foreign language. I don't understand. So if I had a barbershop, okay, and I had a barbershop and I was in, I don't know, outside of a city, and at the moment I'm stocking whatever I can get from the local chemist or whatever, I would stop. I would go straight to a white label company and I would buy a couple of styling products and a shampoo and a conditioner if you do wash the hair, and buy it from them, and buy the retail from them. You can set the price where you want. If you're buying it for 2 or 3 quid a unit, sell it for 10 quid. Mm. You know, you make your own market. You don't have to, you know, if you want, it goes back to also what you're giving your client as a professional. You know, do you want just something you've picked up out of a chemist, or do you want to actually have a product with your name on it?
Mm-hmm.
You can do it, and you can do it cheaply. Yeah. And a lot of their minimum orders are 6 to 12.
Wow. Yeah.
You're not having to buy 200.
Yeah.
You can go to a white label and you can buy six.
That's almost the same as buying from a supplier with their product name all over it. Yeah.
And you know what? The prices are cheaper.
Wow.
And they'll drop ship and you can buy mixed bags and you don't have to, they'll give you the packaging. I mean, it's all done for you.
Well, if you think back in the day, if you think about American Crew, if you had an American crew open and close sign on your door,
right.
That was like a, they're a really well-established barber, yeah. Or they're a well-respected barbershop.
Because you'd be able to get it.
Because you'd be able to get it. Because back in the day, crew wouldn't just sell to anyone.
No.
They used to send a rep in to see what your shop was like.
Yeah, yeah, yep. Absolutely.
You know? Whereas obviously, I remember I saw it in TK Maxx once. Mm.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And not to say that, you know, anything about, crew for me is still an amazing product. Right. Absolutely love it. But when you did have American crew on your door and they used to do all the imagery, don't forget as well, what crew was so ahead of it. They used to make imagery for your shop to put up.
Yep. Yeah.
And they were incredible. David Reculia to me is like, he is an idol of mine for sure. Like I look up to that guy so much. Never actually met him, but I look up to everything he did, not just because he was a fantastic barber, but the story of how American crew started is just phenomenal. I won't go into it, but if anyone wants to know, Google it, it's amazing, right? Yep. And the way they used to supply you everything to your shop isn't being done anymore.
No.
You might get the odd Kerastase photograph, but it's in every single shop, right? The way crew were doing it, because men's products were like so on head, like fiber to have your hair messy when everything was gel. It was like a disruptor. It was like a disruptor of the men's grooming industry, you know? And I think that's why they did so well, because they did disrupt it at a time where men were just getting into hair, when men were just starting to do a little bit more.
Then off the back of that, you had other brands like Baxter's of California, who got snapped up by L'Oreal.
That's right,
literally wiped out. You know, there is American Crew was definitively the first standalone complete men's hair care brand.
Yeah.
There was no one else like before that, you know, Black and White, but there were none of them had the complete package. Mm. American Crew did.
No, yeah. And I mean, everyone still talks very highly of American Crew training systems. I mean, they were head and shoulders away from everybody, to be honest.
That's what I learned a lot of my education from as well, was from them, from Crew.
Yep.
You know, the men's method one and two was like fundamental for me.
Correct.
I use that now. It is funny because I see the stuff that I'm doing now online, and I watch, that is basically the men's work method that I'm, I put my own tweaks and twists. I've used a few other things of someone else on, but that's basically what it was, razor work, all that. You know, it took me ages to learn, it took me ages to practice.
Yeah, no, I've spoken to so many barbers.
They are genuinely amazing.
That have come out of doing courses just to 100%. Give themselves something more with the American Crew one and two. Yeah. There's still great value in that.
Yeah,
but I think the most important thing to remember, a lot of the industry, you know, they consider it that you're trying to sell something.
Mm.
I'm here to cut hair. I'm not here to, you know, I'm not selling product.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But you have to remember that every single client's going to go home. They're going to wash their hair at some point, and they're going to style their hair at some point.
So if you're
sitting there and you're thinking, how can I increase the revenue of my business? If you can start shifting product, and whether it's white label or you buy it from another brand or whatever, but you're actually making a markup on it.
Mm.
That's a passive income.
Yeah, money for nothing.
You know, if you're fully booked and you can't do any more clients that day, well, you know what, you sell five products at, you know, 20 quid a head. You know, that's another 100, you know, you're still making money.
Yeah.
You've got to look at your
markups exist.
Well, I always remember when I used to have my system, we'd print it off every week and we'd sit down with the barbers on Monday morning and we'd go, look, you know, this is how much you made last week, this will be. It was the average bill. People don't never look at your average bill.
Mm.
Now, when you're adding one, if you're adding a product to every other client, your average bill goes from a tenner to maybe about 13, 14 pound. And then you work up, that's your hourly rate, or that's your half an hour rate, for example, right? The average bill is what you should look at when you are running a business.
Correct.
Because that little product sale can just jump it up a little bit more and then a little bit more and a little bit more. So when like you were saying about, if you want to buy a product range, you know, you want to make your own or whatever you want to do, Clients will always want to know what you've used in the hair. You've just got to start that conversation. A lot of clients don't want to have that conversation with you. They want to ask you. You've got to tell them almost a lot of the time.
Yeah, and the issue you now have, okay, this is why having a, even if you do a white label product range, makes more sense. Okay, if you're, I don't know, you're carrying a product range for a well-known company. I'm not going to get drawn in. I nearly said a couple of brands then, but I'm not going to. But you're carrying, you know, product range from a well-known company, and it's in front of the client, and the client goes, oh, is that what you used on my hair? And they went, yeah. And they take a picture of it.
They can
Amazon drop ship it to their house in 24 hours cheaper than you can sell it to them.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's the problem. Yeah. So you're never going to be able to compete with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine, because that's the world we live in.
We live in, yeah.
So white label it.
Yeah. Why, I mean, are you selling to stores or are you selling direct to the public?
Just direct to the public at the moment, yeah. It's not as easy as I think you would think to get into a store. You know, trying to find an email for a buyer is like trying to find Father Christmas, you know? It's like you can't find them. You go on LinkedIn and they're all, you can't even connect with them. You can't even send a message. All the buyers. The buyers are like, I've never even thought that. They're protected, yeah. They are protected. And I never knew that at all. I've got to say, some of it, again, doing anything new is you're always naive to something new. And I thought, you know what, this would be easy. I know a few people at GQ. I know a few people here and there and everywhere. And you think, I'll just reach out. They won't even give it out. No. You've got to go down different. You've got to literally knock on the door 100 times until they listen to you and they go, do you know what, just send me one and get over it.
Or you need to go to Cosmoprof and walk around and hope so you bump into the right people, spend
a
fortune.
It's a bit like who you know what, not what you know a lot.
So you're selling, yours are individual sales?
Yeah, just online. Yeah, just online at the moment.
And yours is two clients?
Ours is in the salon online. We are doing a wholesale package this year. A slimmed down version. It's not the full range. There's certain products we can wholesale quite easily, and there's enough of a markup for salons to be worth their while, and for us, they're ready to start talking about in February. But at the moment, you know, the ideal world, I guess, is if you have a what's interesting about it is that if you're creating a brand, or you're, you know, whether it's a shop front, you know, as a barbershop, or product range, or both. At some point, you know, the dream is to sell it all and to you know, then do whatever it is you want to do.
Exit strategy.
Yeah, your exit strategy. So if you've got a barbershop and then you've got a product range that sits alongside that, and you've also got a bit of a wholesale business and you've also got an online store, well, that's a lot more valuable than just your barbershop.
Yeah.
And if you can limit your outlet, because there's no reason why you can't white label all the way through that zone. It doesn't have to be, you know, the advantage of starting with a white label background is at least you can understand what your market is.
You can understand what sells.
Yeah. How do I need to do that to make it sell?
Yeah. Definitely.
And do you find, I mean, I know with you, certainly from you, yours is a very much more hybrid workforce that you've got here. Are they quite willing to sell? Or do you find getting the are barbers and hairdressers the same? I'm not here to sell product. I'm here to cut hair.
I think
Do you educate?
As much as you can. You know, you can, you know, sit and talk about what you're doing and what the product does and stuff like that. And some people buy and some people don't. But that's no different to anything. Mm. You know, you can, you know, if you're giving commission on product sales, then there's only so much of a margin you can give away. Mm. Like you said in when you're selling American Crew. The idea is that you'd like to think that people within the industry look at it and go, what I'm doing is adding to the service I'm giving to my client. So it goes back to the very early part of the conversation. It's not just about the haircut. You know, if someone comes in and, you know, you've taken your time, given an amazing haircut, styled it, and literally not spoke to them at all about what product you're using, how to blow dry their hair, how to style their hair, how to put the finishing products in their hair, they walk out the door. Mm. They go home and wash their hair and it looks like nothing like what you did. Have you done a complete service on that client? No, you haven't. Because he can't afford to come in every day for a blow dry. So really you should be saying, look, this is how you finish. This is how I blow dry your hair. I use the sea salt spray. This is the paste I put in at the end. If you need
to, a lot of it comes down to education.
To the client.
The amount of education that you give in your consultation at the beginning, middle and end that involves product.
I don't know about you, Dan, but one of the first things I want to know is, What's your routine? How much time do you spend on your hair? Do you use a product? What product do you use? Yeah. How do you find that product? You know, I haven't even spoken to him about how much hair I'm cutting off his head.
Yeah.
You know, do you want to use a hairdryer? Yeah. Do you like using a hairdryer? Do you use a brush? Do you know how to use a brush? And 9 times out of 10, they'll willingly tell you, and often more so now than maybe 5-10 years ago. They are far more knowledgeable about, yeah, I use a hairdryer, I've got a diffuser because I'd like to keep my hair wavy, or I use a nozzle. You know, back in the day that, you know, what shampoo do you use? Oh, whatever the wife's got in the bathroom. Mm. Yeah. You know, that doesn't exist.
I must admit, I used the diffuser on a guy for the first time. Well, not for me, but on him.
Yeah.
And we must have had a 10-minute conversation about what this machine was. Mm. I think that's probably the right time. I think we should finish it on, it's definitely more than a haircut. It's definitely more than just a haircut. And I've really enjoyed listening to your talk of celebrities session and amazed how much Just was used in having a product range and how easy it all seems. So I look forward to seeing an awful lot of new brands coming to the market. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anthony.
Joe.
Pleasure, mate.
Cheers, mate. Thank you very much. That's been The Noble Barber. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to The Noble Barber Podcast. We're always looking for interesting people and interesting stories. If you know someone or you are someone with a great story that you want to share, get in touch and come join me on the sofa. Thanks very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the episode and we'll see you next time.